Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Caravaggio was dead before he was 40, but in his short life, he managed to turn art on its head. His passion for dramatic light defined 17th century art. But he lived his life in the shadowy world of criminals, pimps, and prostitutes. Joining me to talk about the man and his art, Andrew Graham Dixon. He's the author of Caravaggio, A Life Sacred and Profane. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook. Send us a tweet. We have a small selection of Caravaggio's glorious paintings on our website at drshow.org. Good morning to you. It's good to have you here.
It's lovely to be here.
I'm glad you were introduced to the program via taxi cab. That's
I was indeed. Great.
Tell me why you believe Caravaggio is such an important artist.
I think there's art before Caravaggio and there's art after Caravaggio, and they're not the same thing. He arrived on the scene in Italian painting in the 1590s, at a time when the church was in a crisis, art was in a crisis, painting had become this feeble, apologetic, mannered style of expression in Italy at the time. Caravaggio suddenly put into it blood, guts, thunder, drama, excitement. He brought the stories of the Christian faith right into people's hearts by setting those stories in the here and now.
It was fascinating to me looking through the photographs, the gorgeous photographs you have in the book, that each painting somehow lights or is lighted in such a way as to bring that painting to life in a different way than had been done before or was done afterwards.
Absolutely. I mean, in painting, he invented cinematography.
What do you mean?
He's the first person in the history of visual art to light a scene as if he was a lighting cameraman. We're not quite sure how he did it. I found, in the course of researching my book, a very intriguing detail that his landlady throws him out of her house that he's renting from her because he's damaged the ceiling. And I like to think, I visited that street in Rome, and I like to think that Caravaggio knocked a hole through the roof of the house and allowed the noonday sun to flood onto his posed models so that it's like a scene from, say, a Martin Scorsese movie or a Pasolini movie. In fact, I have Martin Scorsese is interviewed in my book because Caravaggio is one of the great influences behind his early cinema.
Really?
Mean Streets, Taxi Driver.
Interesting.
He was going to see Caravaggio paintings when he made those films.
Tell us about the man. How is he, in your view, commonly portrayed?
In the past, he's been portrayed as a lunatic, a romantic outsider, a gay icon in a pre-gay age, I should say, before such terms even really existed. But he's been, for me, portrayed as a series of cardboard cut-out stereotypes, not as a true human being. And in my book, I hope he emerges as a true human being. And the reason I wrote it was because of a truly extraordinary thing that's happened in the last 30 years, which is that we've got this incredibly famous, brilliant artist, a painter of the same stature, say, as Shakespeare is in literature. And suddenly, during the last 30 years, a group of scholars working in different places, publishing their findings in very obscure academic journals, they found his life. They found his detail. They found everything about him. They found who he killed. He killed a man in a sword fight. They found out who killed him. a man with three accomplices cut Caravaggio's face off outside a gay bar in Naples in 1609. They found the prostitutes with whom he consorted, the cardinals with whom he curried favour. We found his life. And that's why I wrote my book, because I thought, my goodness, I have the chance. Because, that, as I say, they were all rather train-spottery. You know, the main man who spent 30 years of his life researching this material published it all in a 100-page book in Latin.
Oh.
In a privately circulated edition. Oh. So I felt that, in a way, I can't claim credit for my own book, in the sense that it represents many, many people's work. But what I've done, because I think it's of such great interest to the general public, this amazing life, this world that he lived in, is I brought it together and tried to give you him and his real world.
What was that early world for him?
Well, his life began with a terrible tragedy, we now know. When he was 6 years old, he was born in the town of Caravaggio, hence his name, but it's a little town, it's just outside Milan. He was actually brought up in Milan. And Milan was struck by a terrible plague when poor little Caravaggio was 6 years old. And he lost his father, his uncle, his grandfather, all his male relations other than his brother, he lost in one day of the plague.
Wow.
And there are these paroxysmal descriptions of how it was in the city at that time. Grave carts carrying the dead across cobbled streets as the people light torches and processions and pray to be saved from damnation. And actually, when I read the descriptions, which I quote in my book, written by a Jesuit who was there at the time, it's as if you're reading a succession of Caravaggio paintings. And it's almost as if you can see in your mind's eye these hands stretching out for help and the torchlight. So I wonder if, in a sense, the impressions that you get when you're very young stay with you forever.
Was he at all sickened?
No. He survived. Bubonic plague, either you survive or you don't. It's a question of where the flea jumps from the rat, I'm afraid to say. But, he had this terribly, terribly difficult life. He was a troubled man. He was a violent man. He had a sense of abandonment that I think went with him wherever he went. And I think he has problems in his relationship with God. He's a Christian believer, I think, but he paints on the edge of doubt. That's the shadow in Caravaggio. It's that darkness of doubt. And he has terrible trouble with authority in the secular political sense. He's a painter who's constantly, the Pope and the cardinals, they want him to be part of their world. But he just somehow can't be that kind of artist. He can't be the artist who doffs his cap, the courtier artist like Michelangelo or Raphael before him. He can't be that. He has to run off away from authority into the street. He has to go and fight with swords. He has to go and be with prostitutes.
Where did that violence come from? How did that begin? What is the first incident we know of in which he was involved?
The very first incident, I think, is the case of the waiter and the artichokes. It's Caravaggio sitting down and he's having his dinner in the Osteria del Moro, the tavern of the Moor, and the waiter serves him some artichokes cooked in butter. And Caravaggio looks at the waiter and says, "Are these artichokes cooked in butter?" And the waiter says, "Yes." And Caravaggio says, "What do you take me for?" And he smashes this plate in the waiter's face, breaks his teeth, opens his jaw, big wound. And we know this because the waiter immediately goes off to the magistrate to file a suit against Caravaggio. Very litigious, these Italians at this period in history. But what's going on? According to the lunatic theory of Caravaggio, this is just an example of his hot-headedness. No. There's always a logic to his violence. He's a violent man in violent times, and he has a very strong sense of honour. What's happening here is that the Roman waiter will serve all of the Romans artichokes in delicious, fragrant Roman olive oil. But because Caravaggio is from Lombardy in the north, the Roman thinks, oh, you're a Lombard. You're from up there in the mountains. You're a cheese-eating, butter-eating sloth, and I'm going to serve you your artichokes. It's basically a racial insult disguised as a piece of food. And if you look, what I've tried to do in every case of Caravaggio's, as it were, crazy violence, I've tried to unpick and to understand the logic behind it. So if another painter talks about him behind his back, Caravaggio will creep up behind that man, behind his back in the middle of the night and smash him on the back of his head with the flat of his sword, knock him out, which is as if to say, I'm not going to fight you face to face because you're not fighting me face to face. You're just insulting me behind my back. That's all you're worth.
Tell me what the authorities did once the waiter filed this complaint.
Well, you see, the thing is, Caravaggio was a very well-connected man. He was in the palace under the patronage of Cardinal Del Monte. And this is what gives him carte blanche to a degree, to pursue his nocturnal activities with such lawless abandon, because what happens constantly, is, you know, a policeman stops him carrying a sword and throws him in jail, and but he's always, the next day, he's always bailed because, oh, Cardinal Del Monte says he must be bailed. So I'm afraid the waiter didn't get any money. He just got a sore face and probably never served a Lombard artichokes drenched with butter again. But yeah, Caravaggio was constantly getting off until, of course, his life spiralled deeply and utterly out of control, and no amount of powerful connections could get him off the death sentence.
How long have you been working on this book?
I have been working on that book. I'm ashamed to say the book took me 10 years to write. 10 years. But it got to the point where my publisher, who lives near me in North London, used to see me on the heath walking my dog, and I would run behind a tree to get away from him. And he once even caught me and came up behind me and said, when am I going to get my manuscript? But no, it's because it's an archival biography, it's involved a huge amount of deep, you know, documentary research.
Andrew Graham Dixon, his new book, Caravaggio, A Life Sacred and Profane. And if you've just joined us, Andrew Graham Dixon is with me. He's written a new biography of the artist Caravaggio. He subtitles that book, A Life Sacred and Profane. You've talked about the fact that he frequented prostitutes. You've talked about the kind of violent behavior that may have come with reason at times in his life. What evidence is there to suggest Caravaggio might have also been a pimp?
Well, circumstantial evidence. Phillida Melandroni, his principal model in a group of series of paintings, was a wonderful, sexy young girl. She appears as St. Catherine of Alexandria. She appears as Judith beheading Holofernes. Gouts of blood spurting in the air. Well, Phillida was a prostitute under the pimpdom, if that word exists, of a man called Ranuccio Tomassoni. Caravaggio takes her from him. Caravaggio ends up killing Ranuccio Tomassoni with a sword, stabbing him through the femoral artery, possibly in an attempt to castrate him during a duel, missing his genitalia and hitting his femoral artery. He bleeds to death in about 18 seconds. The fountains of blood are described.
And why are they dueling?
It's quite probably over Phillida. Caravaggio, whenever he's arrested, and they say, where were you? He said, oh, I was with Menicuccia, I was with Calvia. He's always with one or other of these prostitutes. He paints prostitutes. It's illegal in Counter-Reformation Rome to get a woman to pose for you as an artist. It's not allowed. It's immoral. But there are ways around it, and the principal way around it is to hire the services of a prostitute. My main evidence for suggesting, and I cannot say, and I wouldn't say that it's definite, I'm just thinking, I do think it's quite possible, given the pattern of his behaviour, that he was in fact a pimp, is that there's a particular case where he attacks a man over a woman, and the man goes to the judge. And in the past, in English documents that have translated this, it's been translated as, oh, the argument was over Lena, the woman who stands on her feet, which is code for a prostitute, in Piazza Madama. She's Caravaggio's girl. That's how it's always been translated. But what he actually says is not that. He says she is a Caravaggio girl.
Huh.
A Caravaggio girl. That's how the Italian is. Which suggests to me that there were other Caravaggio girls. And that perhaps this argument over the girl is because this man hasn't been treating one of Caravaggio's prostitutes correctly. Maybe he hasn't paid. Maybe he was violent with her. We don't know. But I can't say for sure, but on the basis of that close reading, I've tried wherever possible to really closely read and closely interrogate the documents, the archive. I've had, in a sense, taken my art historian hat off and put my detective hat on.
One would normally think that an artist like Caravaggio would pay a model if he were, in fact, a pimp. He would be taking money from her.
Well, that would be the advantage of being a pimp, would be that, you know, it may well be that I'm pretty positive that Caravaggio slept with Phyllida. I mean, it seems highly likely that he did. The paintings that he does of her are charged with sexual feeling. He's also sexually attracted to men, and almost certainly has sex with men.
I was going to ask you about that.
He is omnisexual, if you like. But The paintings of Phyllida are so charged with that kind of sexual feeling. But the point of having, a, as it were, a string of prostitutes is that you have a string of free models. You know, Caravaggio perhaps looks after them. He does seem to be doing that. He's always out at night with his sword, which suggests to me that, you know, he's protecting them because he's always out with them. So, you know, that's where I get my... I just have an intuition about it. I was ambivalent about saying that he was a pimp, but on balance, I'd believe that he probably was.
After Tomasini died, Caravaggio fled. Where did he go and why? How was he allowed to continue painting and to continue to sell his paintings?
Powerful supporters.
Again.
This time even more powerful. Throughout his life, there's the shadowy influence of the Colonna family, who are the most powerful family in the whole Milan area. I think from looking at various dates when Caravaggio was born, he was born on the feast day of Archangel Michael, just before a great Christian victory, which was the general in the victory was the father of Costanza Colonna, the Marchesa. I think Caravaggio was always regarded by that family as a lucky child. As a lucky child, and they protected him. So after he kills Tomasoni, Scipione Borghese, the Pope's nephew, declares a banda capitale on his head. That means, you can bring me the body for the reward, or if you can't manage the body, bring me the head. So Caravaggio is under death sentence. He runs off. He's given a carriage, I think, by Costanza Colonna, but we know for sure that he runs off to one of her strongholds in the Alban Hills, about 20 miles outside Rome. And there's this extraordinary picture that he paints that takes you to the heart. It's almost the hinge picture of his whole life. He paints a picture in 1606 in the summer, just after the murder, and it shows Cecco, his painting boy, also his lover, I believe, holding the head, Cecco as David, holding the head of Goliath, except it's Caravaggio's painting boy, and it's Caravaggio's head. Screaming this death scream, gurgling death blood. He looks almost as if he's still alive, you know, in that 20 seconds that they tell us about when your head's been cut off, when you still have consciousness. It's a terrifying picture. But where is that picture today? And where has it been ever since it was painted? It's in the Borghese Gallery.
Ah.
So in other words, that picture is a plea bargain. Caravaggio paints the picture and he sends it to Scipione Borghese, who loves art. Loves Caravaggio's art. He's saying to the Pope, Pope's nephew, the head of the papal justice system, he's saying, here's my head. here's my head in a painting. Let me keep it in real life.
And you will see a photograph of that painting on our website, drshow.org. And by the way, for those of you in Fort Worth or nearby, the Kimball Art Museum has an exhibition, Caravaggio and His Followers in Rome. It's on through January 8th of 2012. So he continues to receive commissions from not only the Borghese family, but others, and continues to develop his work. How does his work change over time?
It darkens. I think he feels a profound, deep sense of remorse for this murder of Tomasoni. Becomes very dark. His remarks become very dark. There's a story, a rather chilling one, of when he's on the run, because he'll spend the rest of his life on the run.
Even though he has his protectors.
He will inhabit pockets of protected space.
I see.
Put it like that.
I see.
In Naples, he's okay, because the Colonna are big in Naples. He runs to Malta. He's okay there, because Malta, he's under protection. But he's always at risk. But his art becomes very dark. And at one point, while he's on the run for another appalling incident, having she's shot a man on the island of Malta, towards the end of his life, he goes into a church in Sicily and they offer him some holy water. And he says, "What's that holy water for?" And they say, "Oh, it's for your venial sins." And he says, "It's no good to me. All my sins are mortal." So you have this sense that he knows that he's damned. I also have the sense, actually, that he paints these wonderful, beautiful, humane, you know, the contrast between his actions and his soul as an artist is so extreme. It's as extreme as the contrast between light and dark. He paints these beautiful, touching, tender, humane, wonderful, compassionate pictures, which are all about trying to remind the deeply, deeply poor people of places like Naples and Sicily and so on, those incredibly poor people beyond salvation almost, that this religion is for them. You may be starving to death, you may be dying of scurvy or plague or whatever it is, but you know, you can come to the church and you can, you know, Christ will help you. That's the message of Caravaggio's art. So there's this absolutely stark contrast, and the art, as I say, becomes very dark.
He tried to become a knight of Malta. Mm. What was that about?
Well, his great protector, Costanza Colonna, her son had also, like Caravaggio, although he was a nobleman, Caravaggio was a mere painter, he had committed a terrible, dreadful crime, so bad that we don't know what it is. And the Pope had said, "I'm going to have him executed," and she'd pleaded with the Pope. And he'd said in the end, "No, all right, he can go and be a Knight of Malta. He can go and fight at the front line of Christendom against Islam, because that's what the Knights of Malta did. And maybe I'll pardon him." And that had worked out for Costanza Colonna's son. And in a very recent document, and really, really recently found out, a very exciting find, we know that Caravaggio, there's a document actually that tells us that it was Costanza's son, the admiral by this time of the fleet of Malta, he's risen that far up, he's been saved, he is the man who takes Caravaggio to Malta. So clearly the Colonna have decided, well, what worked for one difficult young man, maybe will work for Caravaggio
right.
too. Maybe they'll knock some sense into him. And for a while it works, and he paints these wonderful portraits of the Knights of Malta, these grey-beard military heroes who've been Christian soldiers all their life, and you can sense Caravaggio's respect for them. It's almost as if for the first time he's found those fathers, those male relations, those men to look up to that he never had in his life. He's found them. And he paints his way into being a Knight of Malta with this huge, great picture of the beheading of St. John. Shocking, wonderful, great picture. But he has to, if you excuse my vulgar term, he has to screw it up. And he does. And the day before the painting is hung, he goes into the house of the organist of Malta and he shoots a noble knight in the leg.
Why?
We don't know why. A question of honour. Caravaggio, you see, because he'd been made my suspicion is he'd been made a Knight of Malta on merit, which is not a top Knight of Malta, that's very graded. And so maybe this guy had said, "Oh, well, you're not really
something.
A proper Knight of Malta," or something like that. So Caravaggio goes crazy, shoots him in the leg. He gets confined in a stone-cut cell, maximum security prison. He's the only man ever to escape from the stone-cut cell, the maximum security
prison.
So
he had to have help.
Yeah, the grappling irons were found by the side of this pit. I've been in the pit myself. In fact, Knight of Malta locked me in it as a joke for 10 minutes to see how it
he
felt.
He locked you in there?
Yeah, he shut the lid. And then when he let me out, he said, "See, how does it feel to be Caravaggio for 10 minutes? Oh. I was shaking because I got claustrophobia. But no, he managed to escape. He climbed over the perimeter wall. He then climbed down a 500-foot precipice. He then swam 4 miles round to a bay where somehow a boat was waiting, and then he ran off to Sicily.
What was he like physically?
Well, I mean, they say he was stocky, dark-haired.
Stocky.
They say, like his paintings, everything about Caravaggio was black. His hair was black, his eyes were black, his clothes were black. Of course, his clothes were black, because if you were a bit of a skullduggery monger in Rome in the 17th century, you'd wore black because you could melt into the shadows at night. There was no street lighting in those days.
How tall was he?
We don't know. I would reckon, people weren't as tall in those days. I would reckon probably someone like 5'6". He was a very, very fit man, though. I mean, he never lost a sword fight that we know of.
Andrew Graham Dixon, his new biography, Caravaggio, A Life Sacred and Profane. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers. We'll open the phones now. 800-433-8850. First to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Garrett. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. I would just like to hear about Caravaggio's maybe progression of faith as is depicted in his paintings from maybe his early career into his later career.
Sure. Well, it's something one can only infer. But I suppose the great test case example would be if you compared the Supper at Emmaus that he painted at the noonday moment of his career, which is now in the National Gallery in London. It's the first Caravaggio I ever really fell in love with. My mum used to take me to see it. It's a daylit painting. It's full of this sense of religious revelation. The disciple stretches his hands out in awe as Christ appears and blesses the bread and everything. It's about this moment of appearance. And then you look at the picture that he paints of the same subject, the Supper at Emmaus. It's now in Milan. It's done exactly at the moment, just after he's killed Renuccio Tomassoni, and it's as if someone has turned a dimmer switch down in the room.
Huh.
The painting has got so much darker. There's so much less sense of joy. There's so much less sense of you will definitely be saved. It's almost a painting about the possible disappearance of Christ. It's as if Caravaggio literally finds it harder to see salvation. I'm not saying that he intends to paint. See, this is the thing about him that's really interesting. Is that he doesn't necessarily intend to paint that meaning. It's just that he is so naked as an artist. You know, unlike artists who can cover their own feelings by being clever or dissembling their emotions, he can't. He's someone who cannot help letting you know what he feels. So he paints St. Catherine of Alexandria. It's Phyllida in the room with him. He's painting sexy Phyllida as well as St. Catherine. And you can feel the attraction between them. He can't conceal these things. And there's unbearably tragic later paintings. There's a terrible, terrible, beautiful painting. Right at the end of his life, he paints the Adoration of the Shepherds. And he paints Mary as this refugee mother. He paints the shepherds have come to worship. But it's as if there's a force field. And you know that those men are never going to reach that mother and child. They're never going to help that mother and child. And when I look at that painting, I feel that that mother is Caravaggio's mother, the child is Caravaggio. It's a painting about abandonment. It's a painting about darkness creeping up, darkness creeping in. And I'm dwelling on it because I think it's a very interesting question, by the way. And I've talked to a number of priests and people who are believers, Christian believers, about why they love Caravaggio's art. And they've said to me several times, because he also paints the doubt. He leaves room for the doubt that we've all felt.
And the Adoration of the Shepherds, as you just heard described, the most tragic of nativities. Mary is a refugee mother utterly alone in the dark with her defenseless child. You can see that on our website, drshow.org. I'm wondering so much about your own feelings about this man and how his life has affected yours, and that's something I'll want to talk with you after we come back from a short break. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. By Constant Contact, offering email marketing and social media resources for marketing small businesses. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our week-long retrospective of some of our favorite entertainment and pop culture interviews of the year with a performance by Gillian Welch and David Rawlings. And we listen back to our interview with David Carr, who writes the Media Equation column for the New York Times. Join us. But the things I seen in Scarlet Town did mortify my soul. Well, look at that deep well. Look at that
Welcome back. Andrew Graham Dixon is with me. We're talking about his new biography of the artist Caravaggio. The subtitle of that biography, A Life Sacred and Profane. Let's go back to the phones to Hillsdale, New York. Good morning, Noah. You're on the air.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. It's a wonderful show. Thanks for taking my
Thanks.
Call. I recently traveled to Syracuse, where Caravaggio spent some time, and then I became interested in the last year of his life. And I had two questions for the author. I know when he was traveling back to Rome at the end of his life, he was traveling with three paintings, and he stopped in Naples and died in Porto Ercole. I was wondering. Did those paintings, the ship left while he was dying in a hospital, supposedly, did the paintings ever reach the person it was intended for, and what was sort of the end of that story?
Well, you see, you put me in a very awkward position here now, because I mean, would the writer of a terrific crime novel give away what happened right at the end? I mean, surely that's one of the reasons I want people to buy my book.
But of course, you'll answer his question.
Let me tell you this: I spent an awfully long time interrogating some absolutely fascinating documents, which tell us exactly what happened to Caravaggio at the end of his life. And it's an astonishing story. Which is, I don't want to give it all away, but basically, you're quite correct. He travels with three paintings from Naples to
Rome.
He's on his way to Rome. Stops at a place called Palo. I've been there. It's now Silvio Berlusconi type supermodel stuffed hotel for the super rich. But in those days, it was a humble stopping off point for people wishing to make deliveries to Rome. And I think that's where Caravaggio meant to disembark and get his paintings onto a cart and go into Rome with his pardon. Something went wrong. He was arrested. The boat went on without his paintings. And it's said in the mythical accounts of the past that he ran down the beach after the boat and died of malaria in the heat of the noonday sun. He didn't do anything as stupid as that. Caravaggio is a very logical man. One of the things I noticed when I went to the supermodel hotel was the fact that on the wall it still bears the old insignia of the Italian Postal Service, which means that it was a postal station, which means that he could have got a horse, because it's a long, long way from there to Porto Ercole, where he died, 50 miles. So he could have ridden it in a day, and I believe he did ride it in a day. And of the three paintings that survived, there was an almighty wrangle over them after Caravaggio died. There was a great big fight. The Knights of Malta tried to get, well, they actually illegally sequestered them all. They got their agent in Naples to sequester them all. Scipione Borghese sent his people out. Other people wanted them. In the end, only one survives that we know of, and it's a image of St. John, and you can see it in the Borghese Gallery. But no, it's an incredible story. And the saddest thing about it, you know, if you really want to know what happened to him, the bottom line is read my book, because it absolutely, you know, spells it out and tells you, it even tells you the name of the last man who saw him alive. I even have managed to find out the name, which is a tragic thing, of the boat that took Caravaggio to his death in the unsafe harbour of Palo.
So this tweet from David is incorrect. He says, I thought Caravaggio died on a beach within sight of a ship that was to rescue him. Is this not true?
That's not true. He may well have died on a beach. He died at Porto Ercole. But it wasn't within the sight of a boat that was come to rescue him. I mean, it's not far off what was actually happening. As I was going to say, that the saddest thing of all in my new research is the name of the boat was the Santa Maria del Porto Salvo, which in Italian means Saint Mary of the Safe Harbour.
Exactly.
And Caravaggio dies, as I say, in a very unsafe harbour. So.
Here's another tweet. I think that Caravaggio influenced the young Rembrandt. How formal or informal was their interaction?
It wasn't formal, but it's absolutely indisputable. Without Caravaggio, there's no Rembrandt. Rubens was a great, great, great supporter of Caravaggio, and Rubens took Caravaggio paintings to the Low Countries. So there's an absolute straight line of influence. Without Caravaggio, the whole of Dutch painting would look utterly different. I mean, if you look at, for example, portrait such as his portrait of the Maltese knight Martelli, it's a late Rembrandt portrait painted 50 years before Rembrandt had dreamed of his own style. The drama, the lack of decorum, the cutting through of the ordinary sort of, as it were, well-mannered rules, everything that makes Rembrandt very Shakespearean, if you like, well, it also makes him very Caravaggist. Without Caravaggio, there's no Spanish painting. Think of Ribera, think of Velasquez. Without Caravaggio, French painting would look completely different. Think of Géricault, think of Jacques-Louis David. It's no coincidence that the French Academy in Rome is bang in the middle of where all those Caravaggio paintings are to be seen. His influences, Pasolini, Martin Scorsese, his influence has always been deep and profound and immediate, and it's purely through the eye and through the heart. He never had any followers. He never had any disciples. It's just people seeing his pictures and thinking, wow.
All right, to Dayton, Ohio. Good morning, Ann.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Hi. So I actually studied art history and teach art history, and Caravaggio has always been one of my favorite painters to talk about. So my question is that, speaking of this doubt that Caravaggio had in terms of his faith and religion and God, of course, and how much that may be the reason in the way that he painted his religious subject matters. For example, even the saints, right, and Christ, and other characters that actually show up in all paintings that he creates look utterly human. They look like they're people dressed up as people acting out a certain scene instead of kind of emanating any kind of divine sense to them. If your guests would have some thoughts about that.
Well, visually speaking, Caravaggio refuses to have a supernatural imagination. He refuses it. He refuses the language of the Baroque. In a Baroque painting, if a miracle takes place, a fricassee of angels will appear stage left, possibly carrying the Madonna aloft in their arms. Caravaggio does not paint miracles like that, but I think you'd be wrong to think that he doesn't paint miracles at all, that he has a totally secular imagination. Think of the Supper of Emmaus in the National Gallery in London. It's a painting about those who see and a painting about those who don't see. Everything looks exactly as a normal supper scene might look. Three men are seated at a table, an innkeeper looks on, the innkeeper has his hat on. Two of the men realise that a miracle is taking place. How do they know? They know because God has arranged things in the form of a shadow play. The innkeeper's head casts a shadow on the wall behind Christ that gives him her halo. The light that rakes down from the upper left corner touches the bowl of fruit and deposits a shadow on the tablecloth in the shape of a fish, the fish being the ancient mnemonic sign for Jesus Christ. What Caravaggio is saying is, if you had been there that miraculous moment, would you have seen what was happening in the shadows with the light? It's a miracle, but you have to look to see the miracle. It's not that he doesn't believe in the possibility of the miraculous. It's just that he believes if it were to happen, things might look almost exactly as they do right now.
Thanks for your call, Anne, and to Loveland, Ohio. Good morning, David.
Good morning. I'm not sure what I love more, Caravaggio's work or the stories of his life. I have a technical question.
Go right ahead.
I have read that Caravaggio made use of what's sometimes called the camera obscura or some kind of projection methods onto canvas, which he traced and then painted. Can the author verify that? Has he found any evidence of that?
Sure. It's a red herring. It's not true. It didn't happen. There's evidence to suggest when you look at Caravaggio's work that he may have been interested in lenses and in the kind of images that lenses can produce. Galileo, who experimented with lenses, was a fellow guest, if you like, at the Palazzo Madama. Galileo would probably have known Caravaggio because they were both being supported by Cardinal Del Monte, who was a great patron of the arts and the sciences. However, it would be entirely wrong to think that Caravaggio composed and created his scenes using a camera obscura. They're not images of that kind. In fact, the invention of chiaroscuro, which he invents so brilliantly and uses so brilliantly, it's entirely done in order to get away from a narrow, focused realism. It enables him to throw everything that he's not interested in into darkness and merely to spotlight those whose faces, those whose emotions he wants us to see. You try doing that with a camera obscura, you'll see how jolly difficult it is. And my clinching evidence is that when the landlady who locked him out of the house for smashing a hole in the roof of the house, when she did that, she was obliged by law to have an inventory taken of everything that he owned. So we know that Caravaggio had three fencing swords, two daggers, one plate. Obviously wasn't much of a cook, but he definitely did not. This list goes on and on and on and on. It's incredibly detailed. He had a pair of eagle's wings. He had a capuchin robe. He had five large unfinished paintings. But he did not, and this inventorist was very conscientious, he did not have an enormous lens-driven contraption yeah. for the posing of models. So I think it's absolutely just not true. But, you know, there's, as it were, an element of something about the supposition that isn't totally mad, but it's not actually true, to answer your technical question.
All right. To Battle Creek, Michigan. Tom, good morning to you.
Oh, good morning, Diane. My wife in her office has a beautiful reproduction of a Caravaggio work. I believe it's titled Flight into Egypt.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if your guests could perhaps shed some light on the story behind that painting so that I could share that with my wife, who is working diligently right now.
Right. Well, it's an early picture. It's a very charming picture. It's one of two in the Doria Pamphili Gallery. And it shows this beautiful angel coming down. And Joseph can't see the angel, but Mary is aware of the angel. And it's just this very, very beautiful depiction. It's a very soft, sweet, early Caravaggio. It's in many respects a rather uncharacteristic picture. It's untroubled by questions of religious doubt. I mean, in a sense, you know, it's not one of the pictures that electrifies me, but I do love it. It's got a kind of gentleness about it that you don't find in many of his other pictures. And there's this lovely sense, I think, of, you know, Caravaggio does always make it real, and you feel that family are a family of refugees, you know, with their bare feet and the way that they're nestling against each other. You can almost feel the cold.
Does that help, Tom?
Yes.
Does that help?
Yes, it certainly does. It is a very charming painting, and we both came upon it actually at an exhibit of reproductions of Caravaggio, which was at Loyola University Gallery in Chicago, and we both fell in love with the artist and found that particular work to be very charming.
Well, there's a long account of it in my book, and I wouldn't discourage you from purchasing it for your wife for Christmas.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I said earlier I wanted to understand how working on this book for 10 years has affected you. One of the things I've read is that you found his death and the circumstances thereof so tragic that you actually began to cry. And now, recently, there is a report that fragments of his skull were found. How is all this affecting you as an artist in your own right?
Well, I mean, I'm lucky enough that the book's been nominated for a couple of prizes. I've met the other shortlisted authors and, you know, biographers. Often, I hadn't quite realised it's quite common, the sort of biography syndrome, that biographers end up hating their subjects. So one or two of the other people at the dinner would say, "Didn't you end up hating him?" And I didn't end up hating him. I ended up feeling more and more compassionate for this man with this sort of tragic flaw just built into his personality right from the beginning. It's as if it's something, somehow he is like a, you know, it's, my book is truthful, but it has in a strange sense a sort of the pattern of a tragic fiction. And it is very upsetting. I mean, I did find it upsetting when I finally realised, I told my publisher I wouldn't be able to solve the mystery of his death. I didn't feel I would be able to do that, and I was just going to leave it open. And then one night, just at the end, it's 3 a.m, and I was sitting there, and I'd been looking at the dates of some correspondence, and I suddenly realised that in the dates lay the answer. You know, it was my little Sherlock Holmes moment, if you like. And I realised exactly what had happened to Caravaggio, and I did, I have, without being too sentimental about it, I was probably tired and overwrought, but I did shed a few tears, because I just thought, oh, no, did it have to be like that? No, it's so sad, so sad. But, yeah, it's had a profound effect on me writing the book, and as I say, I still feel very passionate about what the book has to say, I hope, which is about releasing him from these constricting straitjackets of stupid stereotype, you know, gay icon, photorealist, lunatic, you know, making him into a real person. That's what I'd like most of all to come through from the book, you know, as well as just a great genius. Huge amounts of my book are just, it's purely about the paintings, not about the drama, the life, the death, the swords, the, you know, the women. But that would be my ambition, is to show people what a sensitive and strange and tragic human being he was, and what a great artist as well.
Andrew Graham Dixon, his new biography, Caravaggio, A Life Sacred and Profane. Just wonderful to talk with you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.